Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations.
Good morning. Welcome to the Early Morning Late Show. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill, who's off this week. Glad to have you listening to Faith Radio, and welcome to a Wednesday morning. Rebecca, nice to see you.
I was just telling you, Neil.
Could have been doing more prep last night, but I taped the football game, so I watched part of that again last night.
That was very important. I understand.
Well, and it was fun. It was kind of fun to see.
Besides, right. No one wants to talk about any other news beyond the Minneapolis Miracle.
Well, you know, we're looking at news, things we're going to talk about today. In fact, a little bit later this hour, we're going to talk about the Fake News Awards, which...
I wasn't nominated.
How can we tell? That's kind of where we're at today. Huh? We'll get to that a little bit later today. We're also going to talk about the how and why to join the Live Free Challenge and get kind of some basics in that and how to make that actually work and get going. Speaking of work... In a few minutes, we'll talk a bit about minimum wage and robots, which are connected, apparently. So,
what a way to start the day.
Oof, yeah. Just in fact, I was looking in my old Boys Life magazine, robot jokes. So, why did the robot cross the road? Because the chicken was out of order. So that's... We should leave the humor to Bill, shouldn't we? That's a bad way to start the day.
Goes up from here, Neil.
It does. So I want to say, it's not fake news, but there's a movement in California to declare independence from the rest of the state. Founders of New California launched their unlikely bid for statehood Monday with the reading of a Declaration of Independence. The group calls the current state of California ungovernable, citing high taxes and a poor business climate. Leaders of the separation movement want to include most of the state's rural counties and leave the big urban coastal areas from San Francisco to Los Angeles behind, which, as I looked on the map, it looked like it's basically anything to the left of the San Andreas Fault. So I don't know if there's
that seems strategic.
I don't know if there's a connection there, but that kind of caught my attention. All right. Well, speaking of California, this caught my attention. A third grader from Stockton, California, proving to have the greenest thumb out of 41,000 other third graders. Tino Bruno recently grew a 29-pound giant cabbage and is turning that leafy green vegetable into cash. All of the 7- and 8-year-olds took part in the National Bonnie Plants Third Grade Cabbage Program, which invites third-grade teachers to challenge their students to see who can grow the biggest cabbage. And the winner receives a $1,000 savings bond for their education. And has coleslaw for the next 15 years, I think. All right. That's some of what is... on not the front page of the news. We'll get to that in a moment. Ben Johnson is going to join us. Ben's senior editor at the Acton Institute, and will give us some good insight on Martin Luther King and his thoughts on the business, all that coming up. Three reasons why Martin Luther King Jr. rejected communism. That's our story to start the morning here in just a minute. Stay tuned. Nine past the hour here on a Wednesday morning, the Early Morning Late Show. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting for Bill Arnold, and we're talking a little bit about California. I should just mention, too, that we need to remember to continue to pray for families affected by the mudslides in California. In fact, rescue crews have turned to recovery efforts now in California. That's trying to clear Highway 101 there, mud and debris, and Montecito certainly seriously affected, and of course lives lost, and so just remember to pray for them. That would be a heartbreaking experience just to have to deal with what they've had to deal with here these last few weeks. All right, let's bring in today's guest to start the morning. Reverend Ben Johnson is the senior editor at the Acton Institute, and his work focuses on the principles necessary to create a free and virtuous society. And he's written a number of things, including Party of Defeat, and before turning to online journalism and editing, he spent more than a decade in all facets of radio broadcasting. So, Ben, welcome back to your to your old stomping grounds here.
Well, I appreciate the welcome and good to be on with you, Neil.
We want to talk today about the article you wrote here just this week celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King, and you suggested that he was not a fan of communism. I thought we should pick up with that.
Yes, you know, there's a sort of a mystique around Martin Luther King Jr. and his views on communism. During the time that he was leading the civil rights movement, certain factions of the American public, particularly Southern segregationists, but also certain factions of the FBI, tried to paint him as a communist. And interestingly, so did certain portions of the KGB. They tried to use him for political propaganda purposes. As it turns out, Martin Luther King Jr. spoke clearly and plainly about his views of communism and rejected it outright in a book in 1957 that he wrote about the Montgomery March called Strive Toward Freedom. And he said there were three reasons that he rejected communism. He had studied communism in 1949, he said, during that time, as well as additional writings by Vladimir Lenin and some other communist leaders. And he said there were three reasons he could never accept it. First of all, he said it was godless. It doesn't believe in any higher power whatever. It believes that everything works through an evolutionary mechanism, which is conjoined to economics. And based on your economic status and economic conflict, you inevitably move from one economic situation, from feudalism to capitalism, ultimately to socialism and communism. So he rejected that. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., for obvious reasons, rejected its atheism. He also said because it rejects God, it rejects any form of complete standard morality, anything that is universally binding. And his exact words were, since for the communists there's no divine government, no absolute moral order, there are no fixed immutable principles. Consequently, anything, force, violence, murder, lying, is a justifiable means toward their end. And then finally, he talked about what flows naturally from that. If you don't believe in God and you don't believe in right and wrong, then you don't believe that the state should be bound by notions of right and wrong. And so he said he rejected their political totalitarianism. Martin Luther King Jr. was marching in order to give everyone the belief that they are children of God, they have human dignity, and that the state should be reined in from violating the rights of black children, allowing them to go to school on an equal basis with white children. And here communism denied that there was a God, denied that there was absolute right and wrong, and denied that the state had any limits on it, that the state had the right to crush your right to read what you like, to worship as you like. And so very naturally, he rejected all of that. His final sort of concluding statement about all of it is so beautiful, I want to quote it, because, of course, Martin Luther King, a man of such eloquence, his exact words were, "Man becomes hardly more in communism than a depersonalized cog in the turning wheel of the state." So that was the way that he left the view of communism and what it means for mankind. Under communism, mankind is nothing except for a means toward the. It's nothing but a means for the government to use for its own ends. He saw every human being as valuable, as a child of God, worthy in itself of all honor and dignity.
You can see how the elements of this kind of communist mindset keep pushing their way into our economic understanding today, though, too, don't they? I mean, it's Dr. King. Had some good insight there that, if we don't guard ourselves, these things are going to keep creeping in.
Yes. You have to have a very clear idea of what it is that you believe. And that's why a program like this is so important, to allow people not only to say, yes, we believe in God, but to extend those principles into every aspect of understanding, to make sure that our faith pervades everything that we see. We see everything through the eye of Jesus Christ from his divine viewpoint. And so in the words of John the Baptist, I must decrease and he must increase in the way that we see things. And King saw this as his view in everything that he did. He wanted to see that human dignity was extended to all of God's children, regardless of race or creed or nationality. In the words that he said so eloquently in the 1963 March for Washington, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics can join hands and say free at last. So we tried to assure that was the case. When it comes to economics, I believe that that means that everyone has the right to work freely, which is what segregation denied people. Segregation deliberately tried to keep blacks in a subjugated position toward whites, and they passed multiple laws that didn't allow blacks to use their God-given freedom because they wanted to exploit them as cheap labor. And to this day, thank goodness, the racial component is gone, but some of the laws are still, some of the economic laws that we have today still prevent people from entering the economic system and rising using their gifts, things like licensing laws. For example, in certain states, you have to have a license to braid hair. So something that 10-year-old girls do on the playground is something you have to ask a license for from the state. So when it comes to people using their God-given gifts and feeding their family and caring for others and having the dignity of a paycheck, I think that this is an area where we can join right behind Martin Luther King and try to extend that dignity to all people.
I guess we think that we're pursuing social justice, but by pursuing socialism, we're actually doing the very opposite, aren't we?
Well, socialism is incredibly dangerous for the reasons that King saw, which is that when it comes to political totalitarianism, you can only have totalitarianism. The root word of totalitarianism is what? Total. Right?
Yeah.
So if the state is the total master of all things, including economics, then it becomes totalitarian. The only way to fight totalitarianism is to assure that its power is broken up, which was the genius of the American founding. Three branches of government. The government power is split between a federalist system of 50 states and Washington, D.C., the federal government. There are rights that are reserved to the people that none of those governments can take away. And when it comes to socialism, it concentrates all of the power in the hands of the government because all of the money and the means of production are concentrated in Washington. And the more money and the more power that you give, the greater the option for corruption and repression and every form of denial of human rights flows from that. So we have to understand, we have to be jealous about guarding our rights and our dignities, and that includes guarding our right to dispose of our income. As Christians, we should willingly give to charity. We should willingly give to the poor. The Epistle of James is so incredibly clear about our obligation and our need to care for the poor. So we need to live that out. And if we don't do it, then the state will step in and we will lose not only our money, but our liberty.
Reverend Ben Johnson is our guest this morning here in the Early Morning Late Show. We're going to take a quick little break and come back and talk more about work and how the government is involved in that process. In fact, we'll get into a conversation on the minimum wage and robots. There's a connection. We'll get to that in a moment. Ben Johnson, senior editor at the Acton Institute, with us today on the Early Morning Late Show. It's 20 past the hour on a Wednesday morning. The Early Morning Late Show is underway. I'm Neil Stabem, sitting in for Bill Arnold this week. And today on the line, we've got Reverend Ben Johnson, senior editor at the Acton Institute. His work has been focusing on the principles necessary to create a free and virtuous society. And we are talking about an article he wrote here just after the first of the year, which, of course, has been happening around the country, increase in minimum wages in states across the nation. And you suggest that there's a robot connection. Talk more about what's going on.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a fun with the title of the article. It was talking about the robot apocalypse, which if you carefully monitor some of the unusual people out in Silicon Valley, they've been obsessed for years about the possibility of a robot apocalypse, of artificial intelligence actually displacing the human race on Earth. Not just taking their jobs, but possibly destroying the human race. People like Elon Musk and others have talked about this for a very long time. And I think we have to be careful, and this calls for ethical principles, which are, of course, what the Christian religion is all about, the Judeo-Christian ethic of making sure that humanity remains privileged upon Earth. And so we have to be careful about how we deal with this. But what the article really dealt with is the fact that the higher the minimum wage goes, the more jobs are done by robots, the more that they are automated. And there was a study that came out from the Institute of Fiscal Studies in the UK, which looked at the national living wage, which is the minimum wage in England. And they found that so far the jobs that have been subject to their minimum wage increase haven't really been that problematic. But once it reaches a certain threshold, then you begin to cut into jobs that can be easily automated, and they will be, by the hundreds of thousands. For example, in California alone, according to one study, California's passed a law where they'll have a $15 an hour minimum wage, the fight for 15, which is going on all over the country. When it reaches $15 an hour, it could cost up to 400,000 jobs. Human beings will have their jobs replaced by robots, or they will have their jobs replaced by their coworkers who have to do twice as much work because they just can't hire anyone else for what they have to pay. So when minimum wage goes up, you see clergy, you see pastors and priests and rabbis and others standing out saying that $15 an hour is a fight for justice. But they need to understand the economic principle. People don't just pay people for the fun of it. People pay people what they have to pay them in order to make their business profitable and to get the work done that they need to get done. If the wages go above a certain level, then they begin to ask themselves, what would it cost me to replace this person with a robot who never takes coffee breaks, never goes on vacation, never calls in sick, won't ever tell off one of my customers? And they begin to find that it's more profitable for them to replace human workers with robots. So the higher the minimum wage goes, the more jobs are destroyed. And that's particularly problematic to tie in with the first part of our conversation. Those who are most affected are young workers. It disproportionately affects minority workers, and it disproportionately affects people who live in areas that are already economically weak. If you live in a poor area where, for example, a rural area or an inner city area where there isn't a lot of capital to begin with, you can't afford to pay the same number of workers even more if you're already stretched to the limit. It should make clear common sense. So when they increase the national wage or the minimum wage in their area to a certain level above what you can pay, jobs have to be shed. One economic study found that every time the minimum wage is increased 10%, unemployment for the lowest wages goes up 5%. So if you're trying to help people, this seems like a bad way of going about it.
It just, that inverse proportion is always troubling, isn't it? I mean, that if one goes up, the other's going down. Sadly, all the time. So is there, what are some better ways or policies that would help to create more flourishing?
Well, instead of trying to raise everyone up to the same level all over the country, understanding that $15 an hour, I heard right before we came on the program, you talked about California and the fact that some people are trying to secede from California.
Yeah.
$15 an hour is not the same in Northern California as it is in San Francisco, for example. So $15 an hour might work there, but it doesn't work somewhere else. So leave wage policy to the lowest level of government, or even better, to workers and to their employers to work out amongst themselves in free contracts. Instead, let's focus on economic opportunity and allowing everyone to get a job and a foot in the door in the first place by expanding access to jobs. So this tax cut policy, we've already seen the recent tax cut has led to bonuses going forward. We've seen many corporations have announced they're going to add new jobs all over the country. When there's a low tax, essentially a low tax regime, with low regulatory burden, and there are low barriers to the entrance of work, so there are fewer licensing requirements, there are fewer requirements for specified specialized degrees to enter a certain area. As long as someone shows a competence to what they're doing, that person should be able to enter the workforce. And if they're no good, then their customers won't continue to go to them. But allow them to get their foot in the door, and primarily you will see more corporations hiring, more people offering their gifts, more people serving one another freely and openly in a free market, and serving one another in their unique specialized ways for the benefit of everyone.
Good words today from Reverend Ben Johnson, senior editor at the Acton Institute. You can find out more about their good work, acton.org. It's A-C-T-O-N, acton.org. Ben, always good to have you on, and I always appreciate your insights and your thoughtfulness, and we're glad to have you part of the Early Morning Late Show.
Well, wonderful, and thank you, and keep telling those jokes.
Well, no, we'll save those for Bill. Thanks anyway. It's 26 past the hour, and you're listening to the Early Morning Late Show.
This is your daily dose of devotion. We buy in bulk and pass the savings on to you.
It's the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio.
It's exactly 30 minutes past the hour on a Wednesday morning. The Early Morning Late Show is underway. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold. Coming up in the next half hour, Ken Kaiser, Dr. Ken Kaiser, Communications Chair of the University of Northwestern, takes a chair with us and review some of the stories in the news today. Could the Russia probe soon be over? That would be good news. Are we going to shut down the government? That may be bad news, and maybe it's all fake news. We'll talk about the fake news awards. All that and more in the moments ahead. Time for a news break right now. Wednesday morning's underway. It's the Early Morning Late Show. I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold today. 35 past the hour. Well, working on building a strong, Christ-centered marriage in 2018. Hope so. Seeking God's face is one of the keys. Matt Lehrer is the founder of Dare to be Different Marriage Mentoring. And he says, when we have a good relationship with God, it's easier to have a good relationship with our spouse.
So my father died in December. He was by far the most godly man I'd ever known. And I got a keepsake from him. It was one of four of his Bibles. And when I opened that thing up, I kid you not, I just want you to imagine you're picturing this man's Bible, and the pages were all tethered. And I want you to imagine for a second visually that you could almost not even read the text because he had so many notes and highlights and ink colors and pens, page after page. I mean, cover to cover, that thing was littered with his thoughts and his notes. That's what seeking God looks like. I'm in the Word. I'm on my knees in my war room. I'm seeking him in prayer. I'm seeking him in reading. And what would God do in this moment? I've got a troubled marriage. What's the Bible say about this particular issue that I have in my marriage? It's hard to make poor choices when you're seeking God in that way.
Seeking God's face. Good insights. 17 days into this new year. How do we have a strong Christ-centered marriage? Well, it starts with seeking the Lord. You can find out more here, that full interview, on myfaithradio.com. You look for Building a Strong Christ-Centered Marriage. Matt Lehrer, L-O-E-H-R. You spell the name and check it out. Coming up in a moment, Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio. Right now, let's talk a little bit about the importance of absolute truth, and that'll set up our conversation as we talk about fake news.
It's a fact. No nation can exist without a fundamental belief in absolute truth. This is Jim Garlow. It is absolutely imperative that we believe in absolute truth, that is, biblical truth. Judges 17:6 says, "Every man did that which was right in his own eyes," referring to the behavior and moral fiber of the people being addressed. It's the same non-belief in absolute truth that permeates our culture today. No nation can long exist without some fundamental belief in that which comprises right and wrong. Even secularists agree that a culture can only survive if its members share the same fundamental values. So what's the secret to cultural survival and the source of such principled living? The answer? The Bible. God's Word. Listen up. We must, as a nation, believe in those principles of truth, those values in God's Word, values by which national life survives. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Twenty-two before the hour. The Early Morning Late Show's underway. That's the walk-up music for Dr. Kent Kaiser, Communications Chair at the University of Northwestern, and we should be playing maybe Skol Vikings or something instead. But, Ken, you were watching the game with everybody else, right?
I watched right up to the very end. It was awesome.
Which, of
totally
course,
unexpected. These are not the Vikings that we've been accustomed to our whole lives.
Yes. You know? That wasn't fake news, huh?
Right.
But, so regardless of what happens beyond that, we'll be looking at that for many years, right?
Like, that's right.
Kind of play of a century, I think that was. So today is supposed to be the day President Trump unveils his fake news awards for what he calls the most dishonest and corrupt outlets of the year. Noted that White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders called the awards a potential event, which is kind of part of it, right? I mean, isn't that the problem, that all the stories are they're potential stories, but maybe not really.
Yeah, no, I love the fact that he's doing these awards. He pushed it off by a couple of days. I've been waiting for longer than I should have to.
But what does that say about you?
But no, it's interesting because fake news is something that actually the term is relatively new, but it's something that even the founders grappled with way back in the beginning of our country, where newspaper reporters, especially pamphleteers, would put out fake information. And how would you, back in those days, how would you even combat it? You didn't have Twitter or anything to combat it. And so this isn't something new, although that term fake news is somewhat new. And there's sort of a traditional concept of what fake news means, and that is news that's promulgated that's actually false, information that's actually false. And recently this poll came out, and it's a little disturbing, this poll, what the findings were. There's a big difference between Republicans and Democrats in terms of what they consider to be fake news. And I thought that everybody would kind of agree that with that traditional definition of fake news, that something, a story that is actually false and purposely false, would be called fake news. But it's less than half of Democrats, only 43% of them consider that to be fake news, while Republicans, it's 52%. It's only 52%. So there's almost half of both Republicans and Democrats who basically think fake news, the actual fake news that we've always considered to be fake news, they think it's okay. It's nuts.
Well, yeah, it's kind of, we just heard Jim Garlow talking about, you know, belief in absolute truth. I mean, we're in trouble if we don't have some sort of standard.
But now there are, since Trump has started talking about fake news, the term has brought quite a bit. And that's what's sort of interesting. And I go back and forth with this with some of my colleagues at other schools, especially those who teach journalism. And I teach public relations, so I'm kind of on the other side. I mean, they always want to say that we're putting out false information or pulling people's legs all the time. But I disagree with that, obviously. But it is interesting to see how they want very much, journalism professors and journalists want very much to keep that definition of fake news very small and keep that traditional meaning. But another meaning for fake news lately has been when a journalist is lazy and doesn't fact check, and there winds up being false information, maybe unknowingly, unwittingly, not on purpose, in an article. And the president has called that fake news. And I would, too. It's not true. And even if there wasn't malice behind that, putting forth that false information, it is still fake news. And what's really bad about those, and people probably maybe even kind of understand this, if an article shows up in a newspaper or if there's a report on television or radio, a news report, and the reporter finds out that it's false, the corrections are never as big as the original story, especially in the newspaper. It's much better on television and radio where the explanation can be made. But it's ridiculous, actually. When you open up the newspaper, and it's usually like on page 2 or something, in tiny print, in a little corner, where they'll say corrections. And sometimes the corrections are amazing how bad the original story was, but nobody ever seems to read the corrections. And so I consider that to be fake news. And again, this poll found a big difference between Republicans and Democrats on this. And Democrats said only 24% of them said that's always fake news, 66% sometimes. Well, Republicans said 48% of Republicans said that's always, and 48% sometimes, and only 2% never. So it's interesting, you know, Republicans really are different from Democrats on that particular kind of fake news. But then there's another category is where the news organization slants its news one way or another. And again, a big difference between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans, basically 2% say that's never fake news, while 10% of Democrats say that's never fake news. But, you know, I think that is, again, I don't know if I would actually put that one into my category of fake news. I would just call that biased news myself. But the one category that is interesting is this poll asked people, what about accurate news stories that just simply cast a politician in a bad light? Now, I personally wouldn't consider that to be fake news, except in a category that they didn't actually poll for, and that's frivolous news. Hmm. And I think that frivolous news fits into this fake news category, and I think that the president has actually talked about that kind of fake news, and that's a frivolous story. For example, people maybe remember when media outlets were reporting on the shoes that Mrs. Trump was wearing, well, as she was boarding a plane to go to the hurricane-ravaged areas in the South. And they didn't, of course, but report on the fact that she changed her shoes into comfortable sneakers once she got there or something like that, or into boots when she got there. But that, to me, is fake news. Who cares? Nobody in the world should care what shoes Melania Trump is wearing at any given time. I mean, unless it's a fashion story, which those were not, they should not care. And yet, so again, I put that into the category of frivolous news. Now, I suppose maybe in this poll that they would say that that's just a story that's meant to cast a politician in bad light. But I think it's just a frivolous story, and I would consider that to be fake news. Many of my journalism professor counterparts, friends elsewhere would say no, but as a PR guy, I say that's fake news.
Well, you know, as a PR guy, and obviously University of Northwestern has a journalism department as well, to have quality reporting, I mean, that's probably more challenging now today than it's been, right? I mean, even when there should be much more access to information.
Well, and I get that it is a challenge because in many cases, especially with newspapers, the budgets have been cut. Yeah. And the revenue just isn't there to create, you know, jobs for fact checking and so on. But I don't think that that takes the blame away from reporting something false. And in that case, even if it's not on purpose, I still think I would call it fake news. And it's unfortunate because there's a ton of it. I do encourage listeners to look at the newspaper on any given day. You know, any major newspaper is going to have a correction section, and it's tiny. But when you read through, sometimes there are whole stories that when you see the corrections, you'll be like, wow, that whole story was wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Dr. Ken Kaiser in studio. He's chairman of the communication department here at the University of Northwestern. And his shoes look great today. 46 past the hour. We're going to talk about other news coming up in just a moment. Twelve minutes before the top of the hour. The Early Morning Late Show is underway. Dr. Kent Kaiser in the studio is a regular occurrence here. And I'm Neil Stavem, sitting in for Bill Arnold, who's off this week. And we've been talking a little bit about fake news. Also, I want to talk a bit about, you know, the reporting of the president's conversations in the cabinet meetings. And, of course, I'm getting lots of conversation about is the president a racist? And, you know, what about these countries that we're dealing with? Immigration issues, you know, we don't want to use potty language, but the fact is that there are differences in the countries in our world.
Right. Yeah. Well, and a big topic, of course, is immigration. And immigration has been a topic for decades now, and there hasn't really been a good solution for what's been happening. We have we've had some immigration. We haven't had immigration reform. What we've had is a number of times where the people who are here illegally were given amnesty and given citizenship and things of this nature. And at this point, that's what's being debated once again. And what the president and many others want is to come up with some kind of a permanent solution. And in the discussions, of course, you know, people have heard he used some bad language, which is unfortunate because that inelegant language, inarticulate language, doesn't help the cause of moving towards immigration reform. But what he was saying, I think, is something – what's underlying what he was saying, I think, is something that many people could agree with. In fact, I can remember more than 25 years ago, there was a liberal – a commentator who wrote a book called In Defense of Elitism, which I actually recommend. It's a very good book. Unfortunately, that writer died shortly after. He was very young. He died right after, and so there wasn't much debate over what he wrote. But I know it created a big swirl in liberal circles because, he was a liberal. But one of the comments that he made in that book was something to the effect that when he was looking at different countries and saying not all countries are equal, he said something to the effect that it's not the same thing to put a man on the moon as it is to put a bone in your nose. And people thought that was really inarticulate language, but you know, Trump was even more inarticulate. But there is something to this idea that there are certain countries where that are better off than others, and certain countries where we probably would find more people who would benefit the United States if we would allow them in. Now, personally, I've always been an advocate for what I call free market of immigration. So I'm really different from a lot of conservatives in this regard, in that I think that we should allow everybody in if they want to come in, as long as they're not a criminal or diseased or something. However, we don't have a free market because, in fact, we have a lot of enticements to come to the United States. So in the form of free education and welfare and all these other things. So I don't think we'd ever get to my ideal of just having this free market where we let people in. But so given the reality of it, we do have all these welfare programs and we have free education and everything else, then we do have to kind of be discerning about who we're allowing in, because you don't want your country just to be just abused by people who are trying to leech off of your society. And that's, I think, what a lot of the policymakers are struggling with is, you know, we say we bring in the poor and we bring in people who are refugees from other countries. But at the same time, we know that we don't have the capacity to care for the entire world. There was a poll that one organization did and extrapolated out to find that there are 700 million people who would like to live in the United States. Well, that's twice our current population. There's no way that we could integrate 700 million people into the United States economy and everybody do well. I mean, we would be bringing ourselves down. And so that's all part of this kind of discussion about who do you allow in. And I think that there are some categories of immigration that could be expanded. I mean, right now, this is kind of – here's a ridiculous – just a little example. Right now, if you're extremely talented, like whether you are an artist or whether you're a scientist or whatever, there's a category for you to come into the United States and work and maybe even become a citizen. If you are an agricultural worker, which they need many of them in the South, especially California and other states, there's a category for you to come into the United States. Now, let's say that you are a business owner in Mexico City. You don't own let's say you own a shoe store or a grocery store or something like that. So you're an entrepreneur and maybe you employ a few people. There is no category for visa for you to come to the United States and start a business. That, to me, is ridiculous. That's a person who would come to the United States and be productive, hire other people, and contribute to our economy. And so these are the kinds of questions that they're struggling with, but Trump doesn't put it in these terms. I mean, I don't think that he's really opposed to really blanket whole countries, people coming here. But I think what he's saying is, you know, there are a few select individuals in countries like, I mean, he mentioned Haiti. I guess he mentioned some African countries. You know, there are some select people in those countries who would be really good here in the United States. And I think he probably recognizes that. But then he also mentioned a lily white country, Norway. Why can't we have more people come from Norway? Well, it's unfortunately he chose that particular country because it's lily white. But what I think he's trying to say is there are a lot more kind of successful, entrepreneurial, you know, motivated, hardworking people that you can identify who might want to come to the United States from Norway than there are from some of these other countries. But again, he puts it in such an inarticulate way that it really does damage to the whole conversation about immigration reform.
Given that, you know, this is the inarticulate, an opportunity to just keep pounding on this, does that mean that Democrats and Republicans are not going to come together? We're talking shutdown, what, possibly tomorrow, right? Friday?
Right. I don't think that they will. You know, I think the Democrats are not going to want – I think that they would get the blame at this point for shutting down the government, which is interesting because they're in the minority. But I think that they would probably get the because what they want to shut down the government over potentially would be over the Dreamers or those kids who were brought to the United States. Some of these aren't really kids anymore, by the way. Some of them are as old as 29 or 30 years old. But these are kids who were brought to the United States by their parents. So through no fault of their own, they find themselves here. And what they've been talking about is wanting amnesty for those so that there would be a path to citizenship for those kids. Now, there's debate over DACA itself. It's the Dreamers, because now the Democrats want to extend that not just to those kids but to their parents. Well, that's what you call chain migration. Yes. So one person's here, so now they get to bring their relatives. So there's debate over that. I don't think they'll want to shut down the government over it.
A lot more we could talk about. We'll just save for next time, because there'll always be news to chat with when Dr. Kent Kaiser comes in. Communication Chair at the University of Northwestern. Make it a regular appearance to your Early Morning Late Show. Kent, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, you're listening to the Early Morning Late Show, and we'll wrap up Hour 1 in just a moment. Great way to start the morning. Some good conversation, and there's more to come. Bill Arnold had a good conversation with Dr. Michael Brown, a radio host, author, theologian. We're going to talk about some important issues of the day and get Faith, Hope, and Clarity with Dr. Brown coming up next hour, as well as Paul Herkman is going to join us to help us understand how we can sign up and make a difference in the Live Free Challenge. That's coming up in February. We've got details about that on our website, where you can go to livefreechallenge.org. Inviting you to be one of the hundreds that join together to walk, run, and ride to raise money for rescue and rehabilitation of trafficking victims. We're taking a bite out of that big issue and partnering with the International Justice Mission. So check out details at livefreechallenge.org. Sign up today, and we'll talk more about it in the hour ahead. Thanks for tuning in to the Early Morning Late Show.
Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.